On to item 15, Stepstone Group presentation.
Just want to frame the discussion with the trustees before we bring in Stepstone.
Here's very low.
You recall that we hired Stepstone Group for two different mandates about 2 years ago. One of them was the private credit implementation mandate, and we had them here in September to review progress towards funding on that. We also hired them in a consultancy capacity to help us build out a direct private equity program. We're about a year and a half into that process now. Rishi has come on board in August.
That's right.
All right. And has kind of taken point on that private equity relationship here. So if there's any questions before we bring them in, I ask Richie to come up here and address those as well. But really the intent of the Stepstone presentation is once a year we ask them to come in, give you a lay of the land, what's going on in private equity world, you know, what's the competitive landscape look like, what's the fundraising landscape look like, provide a update to the board about our forward pacing analysis, how many dollars we expect to deploy in each of the next couple of years to stay or to reach our target, reach and maintain our target allocation, and then give a an assessment of the performance on an, it's a little bit dated, so we're looking at 2017 and backwards here, but you know, with the private equity pieces, it takes a long time for the data to come in. So this is in addition to what Verus provides on a quarterly basis, this provides a little bit of a deep dive analysis of our private equity experience historically. Any questions for myself or for Rishi before we bring in the Stepstone Group in? Okay. We have Tom Keck and Natalie Walker, and we'll bring you in.
Bringing our contestants.
Yeah, right.
I am EA Sixteens off the Nimitz as a background. That's impressive.
I did a, I introduced him at Sackers for a presentation about 4 years ago.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having us.
So, you have a presentation for the board, correct? The floor is yours.
Good morning. Good morning. So I think you've got a presentation from us. We'll run through some of those pages. Hopefully this will be somewhat interactive. So obviously, if there are any questions, please fire away. My name is Tom Keck. I'm a partner at Stepstone, head of research, one of the founders of the firm. My role is essentially working with all the different asset classes to make sure that our investment process is coordinated, is at a consistently high level of quality, and then I also work to develop tools that help our investment process and our portfolio construction processes work more efficiently.
Natalie Walker. So I work specifically with your private markets team here at Contra Costa to make sure that we're implementing all the tools that Tom really kind of spends the time developing with respect to constructing your portfolio specifically and what you're trying to achieve. In addition to that, I'm a member of the research team with Tom based in San Diego. And focus most of my time on U.S. buyout investments.
So I'm going to take 5 or 10 minutes and just talk through a little bit of what the current market environment is, and then Natalie will get into some more specifics about your portfolio. So if you turn to tab one of the presentation that we sent through, I'm just going to start on slide five, which has the headline market overview. This is a chart that shows the spread between private equity returns and public market returns over each of the last 15 or so vintage years. The blue bars are the top quartile spread to the public markets, and the green bars are the median spread to the public markets. So what you can see is over time, the spread for the median private equity fund has narrowed pretty substantially to where today, for the last 10 vintage years or so, they've kind of been about the same. There is a consistent pretty significant spread between the top quartile fund and the public markets. And so this, I think, demonstrates why there's such a focus on manager quality and getting to the right set of strategies, as well as making sure that you aren't paying too much in fees in private equity, because if you just go with kind of the median fund, you're not any better off than if you had stayed in the liquid markets. On slide six, we'll talk a little bit about some of the trends that we're seeing in the private markets specifically. Slide six talks about fundraising. So there has been a lot of capital flowing into private equity in particular since the GFC, the global financial crisis, in 2009. As you can see, 2017 was a record fundraising year. One fund in particular raised $100 billion, so that kind of skewed the numbers a little bit. But even so, over the past two or three years, we've seen about $250 to $275 billion of funds raised each year, and we'll be at about that same level here in 2018. So that's a pretty healthy level of fundraising. Slide seven talks a little bit about deployment of capital, and we'll talk about that on the next couple of slides. So again, if we go back to the global financial crisis, you can see that global investment activity has increased about 2.5 times in the last 9 years. On the right-hand side, we compare the 2009 deployment by region to the 2017 deployment by region. And what that shows is that the recovery in terms of deployment of capital has been most significant in the U.S., without much recovery in terms of the quantum of capital deployed in Europe. The Asia growth in deployment is really the expansion of those markets. Historically, they had not been big destinations for private capital, and in the past decade, we've seen those markets grow fairly substantially. So the spread of regional exposure in private equity has changed fairly dramatically in the last decade. Slide eight focuses in on the U.S. and the buyout market, which is typically about 60 to 70% of the deployment in capital in private markets. On the left-hand side, you see the annual numbers. The blue portion of the columns is debt capital. The green portion is equity capital. So you can see the green portions have been growing for the past 3 or 4 years. The 2018 year-to-date number is 3/4 of the year, so we would expect on a run rate basis that 2018 will deploy more equity in LBOs in the U.S. than in 2017, which, given fundraising trends, is probably what you would expect. Slide nine shows similar information for the European LBO market. Very similar trend there. The blue bars are more in proportion to the green bars here, but otherwise the trend is pretty much the same as far as the change in deployment rate.
Tom, question. Is there any correlation between the volatility in the public markets? It seems to be, I don't know, it feels like it's about 3 years in, it's been pretty volatile, and the state of the private equity market. It looks like the fundraising is robust. It seems like there's almost no correlation. That's what I'm trying to figure out.
So what's interesting, and I'm not a public markets expert, so let me just caveat that right off the bat, but we've actually seen volatility in the public markets be very low, almost to a concerning point. You typically see volatility in the public markets reach a low point right before a financial crisis. So that's something that we've tried to keep an eye on just as a potential indicator of trouble that we should be accounting for as we build these portfolios. So we have seen Valuations in the public markets and valuations in the private markets both grow fairly substantially. We'll talk about that in a couple of slides. I do think that as the valuations in the public markets have grown more rapidly, that institutional investors in particular are looking to expand their exposure to private markets. And so there is more capital that is being recycled into private market portfolios, but also has been flowing into private markets as people are concerned about the expected returns and the potential return of volatility in the public markets. So
it sounds like the correlation is, as the public markets have risen and their valuation is high, you see the bleed over into the private equity
side. I think that's part of it. I mean, in private markets, you do have beta equity exposure in addition to the alpha that we try to find. So, you know, I do think that there is a correlation. It typically tends to be somewhere between 0.5 and 0.8 correlation, you know, 50 to 80% correlation between the private markets and the public markets. So, you know, I do think that there is a fair bit of correlation there.
Okay, thank you.
Slide 10 shows an estimate of the amount of dry powder or capital waiting to be invested into various sectors of the private markets. Overall, you can see that it's been growing at double-digit rates over the past 5 to 7 years. We're reaching almost $2 trillion of capital that has been committed to funds but not yet invested. And so that is potentially a concern in terms of lots of capital looking for places to invest, and therefore it could be driving up valuations to some extent. It's offset to some extent by that growth in the expansion in the regional destinations for capital. But again, this is something that is potentially a concern. Sort of the positive spin on it is that although general partners have been raising a lot of capital, they haven't been investing it as quickly as they've been raising it. So maybe they are demonstrating some discipline that they didn't show 10 years ago.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, if you have a lot of money chasing that investment, then what's the risk of getting into something that's of lesser quality? And so if they're hanging on to the funds that have been committed and still being choosy, then that's
what you pay them for, is for them to be choosy and to wait for the fat pitch coming across the middle of the plate. So there's two different ways you can look at this statistic, and I think we see both. So there's not, I think, one consistent story. I think different managers are demonstrating different tendencies. So you do have to kind of look beneath some of these numbers to really get a sense for what's happening.
Well, if they're getting paid fees on called but undeployed capital, they probably don't have a great incentive to invest tomorrow if they didn't have to, right, if they're getting paid to do it, right?
Well, yes and no. So the fees that you pay on committed capital, they do collect those fees whether they invest it or not. On the other hand, they do have to pay that capital back before they can get their carried interest. So they don't want to run the clock on those fees for too long without investing capital, because it will make it harder for them to eventually earn their carried interest.
Right.
So there is some alignment of incentive that's built into the structure. But generally speaking, they don't need to put capital to work to keep the lights on, which is probably a good thing, because it allows them to show more discipline. Now, on that discipline note, as we look at the next couple of pages, slides 11 and 12 show purchase price multiples in the U.S. and in Europe. And so the whole discipline story looks like it's going out the window a little bit as you see the bars moving up and to the right. So, you know, we have seen increases in valuations paid in the private markets fairly substantially over the past 5 years. It's higher than it was in 2007 and 2008, right before the financial crisis. So it's definitely something that we're keeping a close eye on. I'd say we have the benefit of being able to see the underwriting that general partners are, the assumptions that they're making as they're buying these transactions, because of our co-investment business. And while their underwriting has gotten a little more aggressive than it was 5 years ago, it still hasn't gotten to the kind of unrealistic assumptions that they were making immediately before the global financial crisis. So we do see some elements of discipline, even if the headline numbers on pricing don't really look that way. The other point that I would make on valuations is on slides 13 and 14. So slide 13 compares the EBITDA multiples paid in private markets, which is the blue bars, versus the S&P 500 EBITDA multiple, which is in the green bars. And so what you see is around the global financial crisis, the spread between those two multiples compressed fairly substantially, and it has widened in the past 2 or 3 years. So what I think this is showing you is that the run-up in valuations has been more pronounced in the S&P 500 than it has been in the private markets. We did peel back the layers of the onion a little bit on that to make sure that what we weren't seeing was Google and Facebook and Netflix impacting the S&P 500 multiple. And what we found is that this trend is actually fairly robust to different sizes of companies. And even if you pull out those FANG stocks, the same trend is still true. Slide 14 looks at valuations a slightly different way, which is to say that we have been experiencing over the last decade historically low interest rates. And interest rates can drive equity valuations. So if you adjust equity valuations for the level of interest rates, they actually, for the last 5 or 10 years, equities have been cheap relative to fixed income. Now, with interest rates coming up and with the run-up in valuations, we are now approaching the point where valuations, and this is focused on the S&P 500, are really approaching a kind of a fair value point on an interest rate adjusted standpoint. So that argument that equities are cheap relative to fixed income is becoming less persuasive as interest rates increase and as equity valuations also increase. Slides 15 and 16 look at leverage multiples. 15 is in the U.S. and 16 is in Europe. Similar story here to what you saw on the valuation pages. The multiples have gotten larger generally over the past 5 to 10 years. The availability of leverage is one of the things that also drives purchase price multiples, so there's a high correlation there. One of the things that we look at to figure out if this is something that we should be concerned about is the amount of equity that's also going into these transactions. And those are the lines that you see above the bars. So if you look back to 2006 and 2007, typically there was about 35 to 40% of the capital structure that was in equity beneath the debt, which meant that the capital structure was less survivable in a crisis than today, where you have something like 50 to 60% of the capital structure in equity. So you're not getting as much benefit from leverage driving the returns, but you also have a capital structure that will help you survive a downturn if one comes. And that, we think, is a very good sign for buyouts in particular. Being able to survive through the crisis is one of the things that we have noticed about high-quality managers. That's kind of a secret of success in private equity.
Is that private adaptation behavior, or is that regulatorily driven? in terms of?
I would say it's driven more by the equity than the debt. There has been some regulatory oversight of this, but I think generally speaking, it is that the GPs learned a lesson in the GFC and have been very conscious about the kinds of companies that they're investing in and about the capital structures that they're putting on those companies.
Yeah.
Another example of kind of the more survivable capital structure is on slide 17, the interest coverage ratio for new LBO loans that are coming out. As you can see, in 2007, it was at 1.6, which is pretty low. Over the last decade, it has been well above 2. If you adjust this for, if you normalize interest rates, then the interest coverage ratio does come down to a little bit below 2. So if interest rates were to adjust back to where they were 10 years ago, some companies would be in trouble. But at this point, you know, these capital structures look like they are much better positioned than preceding the GFC. The last few slides that I have here all really talk about liquidity coming back to private equity portfolios. So slide 18 is dividend recaps. Activity has been more muted in this area in the last few years than earlier, but it's still fairly healthy. So we do see a fair amount of liquidity coming off of portfolios from dividends. Slides 19 and 20 lay out the IPO calendar. As you can see, in years past, there have been some very large IPOs that drove the overall fundraising total. We haven't had one of those in the past 4 or 5 years. But on slide 20, we have a pretty full IPO backlog. If some of the recent volatility that has ticked up in the public markets continues, we may not see this backlog change as much, but you know, this is another area where we have been seeing a number of IPOs being filed. And then the last slide that I have on 21 just talks about the secondary market. Again, another indicator of liquidity in the market. The past year or 18 months has been a very good time to be selling private equity funds. You can get just about par for your private equity funds, which means that as a buyer of secondary transactions, it has been more challenging to find excess returns in this market. So that was a quick tour of the kind of overall trends in the market. Happy to entertain any questions or just turn it over to Natalie.
Great. Yeah, feel free to jump in as well. So what we really wanted to do, we wanted to kind of provide an overview of the general private equity landscape today, and then really just kind of focus in on what that means to Contra Costa and in the context of your program. So if you just turn to the second tab, or I guess starting with slide 23, we wanted to provide a review of the private equity program. So really the goal here is to provide you with an update on the program, including the team, the investment approach. And just starting with the team, you know, no changes to the coverage team at Contra Costa since we started working with you about a year and a half ago. Tom, myself, Key, as well as Jose all remain very focused on your portfolio as a very important client of ours. That being said, we have continued to invest in the people at StepStone as well as the coverage of private markets. And so today, you know, just high level update, 150 plus investment professionals across 17 offices globally. And those professionals all service you. So it's Tom, myself's responsibility to take the output from that research and make sure that it's getting captured for Contra Costa. On 24, this just lays out the private equity investment objectives that we identified when we started working with you. I think the punchline really here is that we are trying to build a best-in-class portfolio on your behalf really taking a more concentrated approach, so making sure that you have strong relationships with fewer managers, and really that leads to transparency and less fees. So, you know, based on the history of going primarily through fund-of-funds and or less fee-sensitive approach, we really want to make sure that we take the middle person out and make sure that you have direct relationships with each one of those managers and that it's on preferred fee terms. As a target allocation, you know, your program, just as a reminder, 10% to private markets as well as real assets. Today we sit around that number, so it's really making sure that we're filling in the distributions with top tier managers. Our goal is to be very selective and really just invest with the best private equity funds, and really doing that primarily through U.S. buyout investments.
So if Director Tellis was here, I'll ask in his absence, he'd say, how are we doing? You know, what's your assessment of how we're doing? Because Jerry would want to know that.
Great. So I appreciate the question. So we're going to provide an update with how we're approaching the market, and then I'll provide you an update with the performance under the next tab. I will say it's kind of a tale of two stories, right? So you have the legacy portfolio that kind of predates StepStone, and as I said, was done through more fund-of-funds, which kind of eliminated transparency and increased the amount of fees that you were paying. So I would say, you know, to steal the punchline in the next section, you're operating above average, but certainly we want to be in the top quartile, and that's where our goal is to take this program.
Okay, thank you.
Just in terms of process, I'd say, you know, it's working really well. Tim and Rishi can attest to this, but I think it's been a very open dialogue between your private markets team, your CIO, as well as StepStone. And we continue to kind of have that kind of open construct with, you know, frequent pipeline calls as necessary. Again, appreciating that we're doing kind of less commitments going forward and more meaningful relationships. And then also, in addition to doing kind of the forward planning for the program, the pacing, the pipeline, we're also monitoring your historical investments as well. So we provide quarterly updates on that, as well as annual more holistic updates on the fiscal year performance. So just kind of getting into our process, and this kind of goes back to slide 25, where we talk about how we identify the pipeline at the front of the year. That is based on a lot of work behind the scenes, and one of the things that we look to do with each client, at least on an annual basis, sometimes more, is refresh the pacing. So we'll take you know, how your portfolio is performing as a whole and your forward projections in terms of the growth of your portfolio, as well as how the private equity investments are performing by sub-asset class, to come up with an optimal commitment amount to propose to you to make on an annual basis. So if you look at slide 26, this is the results of that analysis that was done collaboratively with Team and StepStone. And really taking kind of macro factors with some of the tools that Tom talked to earlier in order to come up with this optimal pacing plan for the next 10 years, and really updating this plan on an annual basis, because we understand markets change and things can change in terms of the direction you want to take the portfolio. So just using the baseline of 10% as your target, you can see here at the end of 2017, the portfolio exposure to private markets was 10.8%. And we really have a commitment to maintaining that exposure going forward based on your target allocation of 10%. So over the next few years, we recommend gradually increasing your commitment to private equity, and that's really to backfill some of the distributions that are coming off of the portfolio. So we'll talk about the significant liquidity that is coming back to you. But certainly want to make sure that it's kind of paced and not volatile in terms of the commitment pace. So for the next kind of year to 2 years, we're kind of going to be doing $100 to $200 million of commitments. It's really opportunity driven. So we want to make sure that we're not forced to put dollars to work, but really that the opportunities exist to put put that allocation out. And again, we're doing this more selectively with 2 to 4 commitments per annum, ranging in size from 25 to 100 million per commitment. And again, like I said, we'll make tactical adjustments to this based on market conditions, what you're trying to achieve as a board. So this is kind of the latest update since our annual pacing analysis last year.
So the trend line on this, if I'm looking at the right plate, I think I am, is you have sort of a design dip, right? You go, looks like you're at 10.1% in 2020, and then it ranges down into the nines until 2027.
Yeah.
And that's just you. I understand this is an estimate. You're kind of pro-forming it out. But what's the cause of that? Why?
Yeah, it's a great observation. So the dip is actually caused by significant liquidity projected to come off of your portfolio. So if you look at your legacy investments dating back to kind of 1996, they're still active investments. A lot of those funds are at the tail end, and so the portfolio should be liquidating now. For the next 5 years, we're projecting a lot of distributions coming off of the portfolio based on the vintages of those funds. We've taken a lot of analysis and tried to smooth out those distributions because we know just because a fund is in year 10, it's not going to distribute capital today. So we have tried to kind of modify our pacing analysis specifically for Contra Costa, really with assistance from your team. But that's the dip, is that as these distributions come off the portfolio, the market value goes down, and we're trying to replace that market value with new commitments.
So more money than we know what to do with.
We know what to do with it.
We have some ideas, guys.
Okay.
But I think one of the reasons why we do this pacing analysis is because using funds, it is difficult to dial in a specific number for an exposure. So we typically, as you can see the gray region around the blue line, we typically anticipate that there's going to be some wiggle room around whatever the target is, based on the timing of distributions coming back, based on what's the volatility in the public markets, and so what's the denominator that we're dividing by here. So we try not to measure with a micrometer what we end up cutting with a chainsaw. So that's why we have such a wide band around the estimate there.
And just to contextualize this for the actual experience we've had so far today, I think we originally talked about a $100 million commitment pace to 2 to 4 managers for 2018. We've done 2 managers for a collective total of $70 million. So again, today, for them being selective and opportunistic, we saw 2 opportunities, not 3 this year. I think in the due diligence pipeline right now, we have 2 additional funds for $90 million that'll close, if they complete due diligence, that'll close next year. So this is a little bit of an imprecise science on where the total fund is going to go, where the private equity is going to fit inside that, and what we find in the marketplace. So you've got a couple of moving dynamics here.
Okay.
That's a great point.
Should be noted that the words contextualize and chainsaw were used in back-to-back sentences. And for the record, I just want to know, was your last question yours, or was it on behalf of Mr. Chairman?
No, that was mine. That was mine. That was not Jerry's.
Great. So slide 27, off the back of Tim's comments. So this, we wanted to just capture quickly the pacing for 2018. Again, had kind of this goal of doing $25 to $50 million commitments, 2 to 4 primary fund relationships, and really feel comfortable with the names that we've put forth in the portfolio to date. 1 U.S. small buyout fund, a industrial partner. So just speaking to our own preferences for sector specialists, we have 2 sector specialists here, and that means that in addition to being U.S. buyout focused, They also have sector expertise. So in the case of AE Industrial Partners, that is industrial, as the name suggests, but also has a focus on aerospace as well, which we think there's positive tailwinds in that industry from an investment perspective. And then a U.S. middle market buyout manager, Sierra Capital Group, that focuses on technology businesses. So making sure that the investments we do really are focused on filling out some of the exposures that you either are low on in your portfolio, but more importantly, that there's visibility in what exposures you're going to be getting going forward. So more transparency in the portfolio.
I'd say the other thing that both of these managers share is a value orientation. So given where we are in the cycle, we like having not just the sector expertise, but that value orientation so that we're not buying expensive high growth businesses at the top of the cycle, that we're buying businesses that we think will make it through the cycle, that will be more defensive if there is a downturn, which seems likely in the next fund cycle.
If only we knew when.
Slide 28 seeks to kind of capture how we think about the forward opportunity set. So it's what we call a heat map, and we've identified areas of the market, off of Tom's work, just on a macro basis, where we think there's pockets of attractive opportunity from a private equity perspective. So you can see along the top, there's the sector strategy, so venture ranging from growth equity buyouts, distressed restructuring, secondaries, and co-investments. And then along the side, the subsector and geography, so getting a little more granular in terms of the actual exposure. So the green is what we would call favorable market dynamics from an investment perspective. Blue is neutral, and gray is less favorable. And so we really kind of take this macro view. So you can see here that we've identified, at least in the buyout. So if you look in the middle of the chart, on a buyout basis, the Americas are attractive from a small, medium, and large perspective, less favorable from a global fund size, where the purchase prices are a lot higher, but also just kind of the growth and or value creation dynamics not as favorable. And then in addition to that, Asia is also an attractive area of investment in the buyout landscape, both in small, medium, and large sized funds. And then in terms of the other areas, we think co-investment is an attractive area for investment because you can reduce fees and obviously have even a more customized approach to your private equity portfolio exposures. And then in addition to that, growth equity and venture capital in Europe and Asia, different pockets of opportunity there as well. So we take these heat maps and really kind of hone in on what Contra Costa is trying to achieve. We do have a preference that we laid out at the beginning of the relationship for focusing on U.S.-based funds. So what that means is that the opportunity set specifically for Contra Costa in the next year is really going to be probably primarily U.S. middle, small, and large buyout funds. In addition to that, the one area that's a little bit more cyclical that we'll look to lean into, depending on the cycle, is distressed restructuring. So if there are, cracks, which we've been beginning to see in the environment on the debt side, we will potentially consider a distressed debt or structuring fund as a defensive move. So if you look at page 29, really kind of thinking through the next 12 to 18 months, this is where I think our focus will reside from a primary fund commitment perspective.
Okay.
Any questions on the program, priorities, pipeline? So just getting back to your question, Scott, in terms of the performance, The next section, starting with page 31, really just kind of gives you an update on the legacy portfolio and the performance. So a couple key takeaways here. So on page 31, just wanted to draw your attention. You know, first, 31 commitments to 14 managers representing about $1.6 billion in commitments. That $1.6 billion of commitments is sitting around $950 million of market value today. And since inception has generated a 9.5% net internal rate of return and a 1.4x multiple. Importantly, the DPI number really speaks to how much of the capital that you've put back has come or put out has come back to your plan. So that's around 70 cents on the dollar. So for every dollar you invested, you got 70 cents back to date. But that's not to say that there's not a lot of near-term liquidity, and we have seen that in the last 12 months. So on an inception-to-date basis, your IRR has been 9.5%, but I think it's worth noting that the last 12 months has been an exceptional year for your plan, and this is as of 6/30/2018, so 14.3% net IRR just in the last 12 months with a lot of liquidity. On page 32, we wanted to just provide some context for how you have performed relative to benchmarks. So both private benchmarks where we use the Burgess Private IQ as well as public markets here. We use the S&P 500. And then in addition to that, we've layered on to public markets and a liquidity premium to compensate for the fact that you can't get your money out like you could a public stock.
Is the judgment of performance against benchmark in the private equity a stronger valuable measurement? I'm asking because just looking at the benchmarks, and particularly how one of them was described, they seem to be fluid, they're changed and updated continuously. So I'm wondering what, in terms of a benchmark, how that, you know, in other words, is this a real good indicator of performance?
Yeah, so first I'll say no benchmarks are perfect. We do try to make sure that the benchmark we're using is relevant to your portfolio. So certainly the most relevant one would be private benchmarks. How have other private investments performed relative to your portfolio? And then on the public side, you know, it's really seeks to kind of look at what is in your portfolio and how we can compare it to types of stocks, so whether they're small, mid, or large cap stocks, as well as domestic versus international. Your portfolio is predominantly U.S.-based, so the S&P is appropriate from a geographic perspective. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of look-through in terms of the actual portfolio companies because they're in fund-to-funds, so there's an additional layer of opaqueness. So we have used the S&P 500 historically, and I would say the liquidity premium here is probably on the high side. So most of liquidity premiums are between 100 and 500 basis points. Here it's 400, so we could kind of take a look at reassessing that in the context of what we think private equity will do or outperform public markets going forward.
And Scott, just for your reference, the S&P 500 plus 4% has been the private equity benchmark since the late 90s. And I think if you look back, the slide Tom was using on slide 5, you know, 400 basis point premium over the public markets was pretty much what people were experiencing in the late 90s, early 2000s. If you look at that downward trend as we get more efficient here, 400 basis points, well, I would love to achieve that, is probably not realistic, particularly when the public equity markets are having exceptionally strong years. So I think coming down to something closer to 200 is probably more of a reasonable figure.
Okay.
Natalie, on the private pool benchmark, do those include fees or not?
Yeah, they're all net returns.
Their net return. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Net LP. So, you know, I think we typically try to focus attention on the long-term return in private equity and take out kind of the noise of short term. So, you know, the since inception net IRR of 9.5%, as I said, is above median. So the median private equity return, the third gray bar, was 9.4%. But of course, we're trying to get closer to upper quartile, the 16.9%. The last 12 months, you know, we're closer to that in terms of your portfolio, 14.3%. And there have been some more recent investments on the private equity side that I think are driving some of that short-term outperformance, both in terms of secondaries and special situations that have shorter duration and higher IRRs. So on page 33, this is just a valuation bridge. Again, we just wanted to show the significant value gains in the last 12 months ending June. So 14.3% was the one-year IRR. Importantly, on page 34, we look at the cash flows both going out. So the contributions are in the blue, so those are negative numbers that went out of the plan. And the gray bars are distributions coming back to you and your beneficiaries. For the 12 months ended June, it was approximately break even. However, kind of the first half of 2018, you've been net cash flow positive. And that's important because it's the first time in the fund's history that you have been net cash flow positive. So really kind of playing with house money, hopefully, going forward. And the last one I wanted to touch upon is something that we've worked extensively with your team, as well as the general partners in your portfolio, to make sure that there's more transparency going forward. So just because you are in fund of funds, historically, we want to make sure that we're making every effort to get as much information from those funds as possible so that we know going forward what exposures you have today and what exposures we may look to add going forward. So we do this on a fund level, so that's underlying fund level, as well as an underlying portfolio company level, and the goal going forward would be to do this for all investments that we have portfolio company level data. So on a strategy basis, about two-thirds of your portfolio is either in buyout investments or real assets. Going forward, we expect that to be more in the buyout category. And that will be kind of market dependent and may lean into real assets if the markets change and the opportunity is more attractive. By an investment manager, your exposure is really concentrated in a handful of names between Adams Street, Sigler Guff, Pathway, and Ares. Represents more than half of your portfolio, so expect there to be a little bit more diversity on a manager basis going forward. And then on the underlying look-through basis, so for a private equity fund, that would mean portfolio companies, and for a fund of funds, it probably means the underlying funds. And you really, one thing to note, and this goes back to Scott's question about that dip or the distribution pace going forward, is that about 50% of your exposure is over 10 years old. So that's important in that you're hitting a point where most of those funds should be liquidating. Fund to funds do have longer lives, typically up to kind of 20 plus years, just because there's some investments that may take a little bit longer to exit. But we would expect to see kind of distributions for the next 5 years from those funds. And then by industry, I think this was an improvement in terms of the ability to report. So we've taken it one step further and tried to do a look through in terms of the actual GICS sectors that you have exposure to in your private markets portfolio, and we'll continue to try to improve upon this. So technology is about a quarter of your portfolio, followed by energy, industrials, as well as consumer. So, you know, one area that we may look to add exposure in the future may be healthcare, either through a generalist or a sector specialist fund.
So this page, Natalie, I think is great. This sort of dashboard view of the portfolio is real helpful, the most helpful thing to me.
Great.
Very good.
So that concludes our prepared remarks. Happy to answer any additional questions.
Any questions?
Jerry doesn't have any more questions.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Slide. That's just in one place you find out so much.
Very good.